Hello and welcome to Lot Awful Movies, number 34, if I've got my abacus working correctly. How are you doing, Andrew?
Well, I have a paralegal hired as an accountant to tell me which number of Lot Awful Movies this is. I am fantastic, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good. Or am I an accountant hired as a paralegal? I think that would be...
Ooh.
I'm that, because I'm the OA official paralegal, and I'm... an accountant, so I'm the girl from this movie, is what you're saying.
You are, and you know, I've been oddly attracted to you since the beginning. So,
and it's great. It's like, you know, we watched Brewster's Millions, and I want to emphasize this was Andrew's fault. Take no responsibility. I wanted to watch Bluff City Law. Hopefully, we can get to that next month because that looks like a steaming pile of crap. But you know, occasionally you gotta do an '80s movie to make Andrew happy. Was this as '80s as you possibly could have wanted?
This was a very '80s movie, but I have to tell you, this was one of my favorite movies from my childhood.
Oh my god!
And
it's so
spoiler.
Bad.
It does not hold up great.
We all like the cast shitty is movies amazing. When we were kids, and this movie is fucking terrible. It is awful.
Really? Okay.
Can you name a joke? Name a joke that's in this movie. I'm exaggerating. I'd have to say name like three jokes, because I think I wrote down like two, and I chuckled at one. And then there's like one other one.
I still use whenever there is Chateau Lafitte on the menu. I still use the like, you guys like Lafitte? I don't know. I just always found that funny. But
yeah, right. Fine.
You know.
All right. But there are not very much. There aren't jokes. It's the weirdest thing. It's a comedy in which they forgot the joke part. It's just like.
They forget a lot of
yeah,
jokes.
The entire thing is just like, oh, well, they're kind of in a goofy situation. So that, and also it's, of course, it's Richard Pryor and John Candy. So that should be funny, right? Is that enough? Or do we have to do more work than that? Or is that enough work? We're done with it. Let's go home. Let's do some cocaine.
Richard.
It's 1985.
Yeah, it's 1985. It's Richard Pryor and John Candy. A lot of cocaine.
I saw on the Wikipedia, it was like, One of the I don't know, the director or somebody was quoted as saying, well, you know, unfortunately, Richard Pryor, you know, only thought he was funny if he was on drugs. But other than that, you know, it was fun working with him. So he's probably just out of his mind this entire movie.
Yep. But this movie has a law premise and a baseball premise, and it's shot in the 1980s. Although, you know, for being shot in the 1980s and having a couple of montage sequences, like the soundtrack isn't very good either. Like,
yeah,
it really needs some Survivor in the soundtrack.
I would say the most 80s thing about it was the like curious hotel redesign.
The design, the interior decorator. Yeah, was very, very 80s. All right. But we've done anything, any pre-show notes?
I mean, kind of, because the movie felt like, you know what this needs, this thing in which we didn't write any jokes, it's not funny. It needs like a little preamble, like a mini paragraph just to let people know what they're in for. What was that about? Did you write down the text? I didn't catch it all, except it was like the weirdest thing, and you would never do that nowadays, I think. But it was like, what happens? What was it? Do you have it on you?
Yeah, I don't have it word for word, but having seen the movie enough, it was like, this is the story of the man who gets handed the American dream on a very hot plate, which is kind of ridiculous. All right, so we watched Brewster's Millions, and the plot is Richard Pryor is Montgomery Brewster, minor league baseball pitcher. Slight rabbit trail here. Richard Pryor was 45 at the time of this movie.
Wow.
And really kind of, I mean, you know, I guess he could look late 30s, right? I mean, you know.
He's so tiny. I wouldn't have guessed he was 45. I would have thought he was, 30-something.
Yeah. If the people you're picking for your movie are professional athletes, don't know that Richard Pryor and John Candy are...
My note is like, look, catchers already have enough knee problems without being John Candy. That's all I have to say.
But interesting. We can get to this. There are actual professional baseball players who play the baseball players in the movie, which doesn't stop the baseball scenes from being god awful movies, Christian movie level bad sportsing.
Well, and not only that. Look, sure, it was 1985, but I'm pretty sure you could get access to real baseball sounds back then. It's not like,
oh my god,
they're ripping the homers, and it's like, punk. It's like a weird, it doesn't even, or like, I can't, I don't even know what it was, but it wasn't a baseball sound. It drove me nuts.
I have that exact same note. So we'll get to it. So anyway, so the plot is, Montgomery Brewster, minor league baseball pitcher, has a quirky uncle and inherits a will where, if he can spend $30 million in 30 days with no assets to show for it, he will inherit $300 million. This is a remake, and I'm not making this up, of a movie and stuff that goes back to like 1902.
That's right.
So apparently this has been a longstanding conceit in
American culture. To know. I went on a mini deep dive on this very thing.
Oh,
because here's the thing. We'll get to it. Well, let's do it. We might as well do it now. 1902 novel and then a 1906 Broadway play. Which is, I would be curious to see what it was like back then, because like, this isn't funny. So, but maybe whatever happened here was funny to them because it was 1906, you know, like when you see a comedy,
like in 1906, anything was that funny? Isn't dying of dysentery was funny.
Yeah, exactly.
The Kaiser has a wicket in his mustache.
Exactly. So, but here's the funny thing. Okay, quick mini dive time. I was just clicking through the history, and you know, this has been remade a million times. And the first like four or five movies, if you click on them, like if you click on all, there's a specific Wikipedia entry that has like all of them. For some reason I can't find it now, but it lists them all. And like the first four or five say considered lost, a lost film. I was like, wow, that's how weird. And so I was just clicking through that. And, you know, that has to do with like the fact that they actually made the film with, I don't know, lettuce or something. They used to make it with something that just did not last. Like they made these silent movie era films on just some bullshit film that just degraded and like melted and stuff. So it's super depressing though, because all these films are like lost. There's just like half of them or more. And then even like into the, I think the 30s through 50s, all these old films, like something like half of those are lost. And then like even more of the silent film era are lost. And I was just looking into that, and I just happened to click on, you know, Fatty Arbuckle is a name that, you know, is old timey, whatever. And it said, cause I was like, how are all these lost? And it said, this one was lost. And I didn't know any of this. Fatty Arbuckle. Do you know this story? He was charged with raping and killing an actor, an actress. And yet, so I read through the whole, I just went, cause this movie was stupid. I didn't even want to watch it. So I was just reading the Wikipedia the whole time about this insane story. And here's the thing, in my 2019 frame of mind, when I see that Fatty Arbuckle was charged with this, but he actually got, there were three trials and he was a hung jury each time or something. And in my mind, I'm like, well, he obviously fucking did it. Cause like, let's face it. I mean, it doesn't take much for me to think a 19 teens, you know, like comedian would be an awful person who might, you know, like do this. And that, but like, it turns out it's a crazy story. He was like totally unfairly. It seems like completely unfairly set up. And there's all this yellow journalism and there's all these people who said like, yeah, there's different people who like bribed jurors and stuff. And like, it turned out this actress like just had this really bad health condition. And she, and because it's so funny, it's so many levels of interest on this, because they were partying in a hotel room with bootleg alcohol, because it's not, you know, it's fucking prohibition era. She already had a health problem that like made her, you know, her body didn't react well to alcohol, let alone bootleg alcohol. And like by all the accounts of people who were actually there, Fatty Arbuckle tried to like help her and like put her, like gave her ice and stuff and all this stuff. And it was like warped into the story of how he like, you know, sexually assaulted her. And then his overweight body crushed her and ruptured her bladder. And then like real doctors, like that's not how any of that works. But at the time, it's like a super crazy story. At the time, everybody just assumed he did it. And so a bunch of his movies, including his version of Brewster's Millions, was lost because they were intentionally destroyed. Because for a while, everybody was like, we hate this guy. We're sure he did this. And so they destroyed like a bunch of his movies. And then eventually, like he, you know, was able to somewhat get some level of, I don't know, vindication or whatever. It became clear like, oh, this was really shitty. Didn't actually happen. And, but he was like just ruined by it. And I was just absolutely sucked into this, Wikipedia, wormhole. So sorry, that was my mini.
That's fascinating. Amazing. Also, do we have the stats on Fatty Arbuckle? Because I have this, you know,
yeah. 193 like, pounds probably.
Right. Yeah. I was like, it's 1934. It was before like the standard, you know, American diet here. So yeah, I'm sure he was probably like, oh man, if only I could be as thin as Fatty Arbuckle someday.
I do want to. Yeah, does it have his weight? Let's see, Fatty Arbuckle. Here, I'll do the deep dive. And
don't. You're gonna be like, hey, it was 5'11" and 178. You know, which was,
well, it does say he weighed in excess of 13 pounds at birth. So that's fucking insane. As someone who's had a kid, that is not possible. So that's fake. But that might have been the origin. That might actually been the one. I don't see anything like yeah, he's a little overweight, but
he was a fat baby. Right, great.
By today's standards, I mean this is great. Anyway, that was crazy. That's the lost gold thing. All that is there to say, Brewster's Millions.
Welcome to our show, all about Fatty Arbuckle.
Yeah.
So now to this 1985 movie. We start as all great movies do, with a minor league baseball game. and my first two notes here are, man, the visual quality on this movie is just terrible. It's like, cause you know, when you accidentally like
the best
record
thing about it.
A low def channel and you're like, how the hell did I ever watch TV in this, you know, but like, this is like to regular definition, what regular definition is to high definition.
Well, what did you watch it on? I watched it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah, I watched it on Amazon Prime, and it was just
maybe everything else was so bad I didn't even think to notice this.
and then the first note I have is, oh, fuck me, the Foley guy is terrible too. Like, because it opens up with a guy hitting the ball out of the park. Like, he's supposed to be crushing it, but Tom, as you pointed out, like, the sound, it's like halfway in between like when you hit a wiffle ball with the like big fat red plastic bat.
Yeah, and like a wood block that would be in an orchestra or something.
Yes. Exactly right. That's exactly, I think that's how they made that. They had
a
wiffle bat.
This just in, Fatty Arbuckle, somewhere between 250 and 300 pounds. So big guy. Yeah. That's
All right. He's fair enough. Okay,
Even by today's standards, pretty big. Yep. But yeah. All right. So I can't decide, and I think the movie can't decide. I want to ask your professional opinion because you're an expert on Brewster's Millions.
Yes.
Were they trying to go for Brewster is an okay ball player or not? Because in the beginning, he's throwing pitches, you know, and it's Richard Pryor. Like, he looks pretty bad, but not horrible. Like, I've seen worse fake sport stuff, you know, like he's throwing pitches, whatever. They're probably 60 miles an hour, but what, you know. He's throwing
They're it. Probably 12. I mean, like, they're as somebody who's, you know, coached high school kids pitching, like, well, little league kids pitching, like, yeah, no, that it, his pitching mechanics are terrible.
Yeah. But yeah, I've seen worse movie sports. I'm just
in
saying.
Movies. The only pitching I've ever seen worse in movies is in Bull Durham, right? Like, Nuke LaLoosh's mechanics would result in you know, throwing the ball through your own penis at 4 miles an hour. Anyway,
that's a hell of a kidney stone coming at you. But what I want to know is, does the movie want him? Yeah, yes, we both know he's horrible in real life, but like, does the movie want him to be pretty good for a minor league player, like on the cusp of getting called up, but never quite?
No, no. The movie wants him to be the kind of the archetype, kind of the archetype of the guy who just won't pack him up, right? And he's okay.
But he's still
right?
starting a game. Like he's still
he's starting the game, but notice that like and this is I do have this as one of my baseball notes. He's pitching in the ninth inning of a 9-8 baseball game.
Oh, okay.
And I'm sitting there going like by the way, the manager is Jerry Orbach.
Yeah.
He's amazing. Right.
From Law and Order or whatever.
From Law and Order, yeah.
Can you believe he died in 2005? I thought that was like yesterday. I would have guessed like 4 years ago.
I know. Me too. I would not have thought 2005. But yeah. So so Lenny is the manager.
Well, hold on.
Great.
I was in the middle of something. So you don't think he's supposed to be decent. You think he's actually just not a great.
I think he's supposed to be okay for where he is.
Yeah.
Right. But he's playing on the Hackensack Bulls, which are clearly like an independent, you know, low level team.
But
right?
what they do, so what they've decided is like, this is why I don't know, because he pitches and the movie, I can't tell like he's supposed to be good. But then what happens almost every pitch is that someone cranks a home run, but 2 inches foul.
Right.
And I don't know, like, what is the magic that keeps happening? Like, what is it about him that means they crank a home run but 2 inches foul every time? I couldn't decide what
so
they were
here's,
going for.
Here's why. Here's the actual baseball thing of why that happens, right? And that is, if your pitches are so slow.
Yeah, you just wrap
that, like,
around on them.
Right,
time.
That the
but
batter's
even
just
lefties and righties were
front.
Doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but you're right.
Yeah, and so like that's how he gets the guy out, and then he does the stupidest fucking shit in the world, which even for this movie took me right out of it. Which he gets 2 strikes on the guy by having him hit just crushing homers, but like 2 inches foul, and then he does a slow pitch.
Yeah, the like Ephus pitch. Yeah,
literally throws it up in the air like a slow pitch softball. And look, even I can hit a home run off that. That's why it's slow pitch softball. And then the guy is like so confused, he like swings and falls over. It's really good 1906 comedy, is I guess what I would say. I can really picture a Fatty Arbuckle just swinging and falling over. It'd be hilarious.
Yeah, that was
for 1906. And it's helped by the fact that the film goes a little too fast. You know, it's like and then like the piano's playing in the background, and then Fatty Arbuckle goes like, "Oh, it's all too fast." Ooh, and he swings and just or whatever. That's how. It was
well,
funny.
I say that Ephus pitch is better than dying of rickets. So, you know. Yeah. So that's how it gets about. He throws the Ephus, which again. Major
what,
league
what
ball
are you
players,
talking about that? What is that? Now I need to know the terminology here.
So the Ephus pitch is exactly what he throws. It's where like, but in order for it to work, right, you have to be throwing major league velocity beforehand.
Oh, yeah.
And then you throw and what you do is you release your arm. You also have to go through your regular delivery, right? But you release your arm high and you let the ball roll off your fingertips, so it does this like huge arcing thing. And if the batter's been locked in on, you know, you're throwing 90, and then all of a sudden you throw it at 32 miles an hour, they swing out.
Okay, but it's not going 40 feet in the air, is it?
No.
Is this a real pitch that has happened in Major League Baseball ever?
It is a real pitch that has happened a couple of times in Major League Baseball as a trick. Yeah.
Right.
Well, there you have it. So, that he strikes out Rudy on the Ephus pitch. And then we cut away to the bar, which, they're the Hackensack, New Jersey Bulls, but they've pulled the, like, stock footage of, like, every bar in Alabama ever. It's a place called Torchy's, and it's pretty honky tonk for New Jersey. But Richard Pryor is in there, and he is Richard Pryoring the hell out of 2 girls at this bar. And the only note I have on this scene is
so dumb.
it is.
They're
dumb.
Hitting on these 2 girls who then happen to exactly be the already romantic partners of the rival team, but they were just there hanging out before the guys got. It doesn't. None of that makes any sense. That's not.
None of that makes any sense. The other, so it's kind of a metaphor for the movie, because like lots of the movie, you're like, as soon as I sat down to like take notes and write about it, I was like, well, that doesn't make any fucking sense.
Yeah, none of it does.
And the waitress goes over to the phone, like as soon as the girlfriend's boyfriends come in, who are Rudy and the other guy, right? As soon as they come in, she goes over to the phone, and then it cuts away, and then it cuts back, and she's talking to the police, and she's like, yeah, 911, there's going to be a fight over here. And you're like, wait, you don't know that. Like, but you do know that because you've read the script, I guess. And then
that's the least egregious example in this movie. I'm glad you've locked in on the one thing that actually did make sense, which is these guys are clearly going to fight. And so she's like, all right, there's going to be a fight.
Yeah, but she goes over to the phone before they're anyway.
Like a continuity issue. Like she. Yeah. Okay. I missed that. Sorry.
So there's a bar fight, and then we cut over to the jail/court scene where Richard Pryor and John Candy. Oh, by the way, Richard Pryor is the ragarm pitcher, and John Candy is his catcher, and they're the only two who got arrested.
Yeah, I know. And their first bit of bad law, we get the court scene.
Yeah,
and I just typed, "This is bad law."
Yeah, it's real bad law. So
she says,
so
and I have a quote. The judge says, "We already have depositions from dozens of witnesses." I'm like, this just happened. What do you what?
I have the same note. Yeah, so they're in jail. Lenny shows up and tells them that the team's not going to bail them out. So they're cut. They've been released, and then I have the note that says, "Well, comedy demands that we arraign you together." There Brewster and Nolan get called in to be arraigned on charges of assault and creating a public disturbance and everything. And as you point out, the sassy black judge decides that she has her first line is, "I have depositions from over a dozen eyewitnesses," and my note is just, no, you don't.
No, you don't.
That's not what you might have is you might have testimony, you might have a statement a police officer quoting, but this is an arraignment, not a trial, and there aren't nobody's taken any depositions of anybody. No, you don't. And the comedy bit here, and this is genuinely not funny.
None of it is. Didn't laugh. I think I laughed once.
Really?
And hopefully we get to the. I'll see where it is if I can remember.
is John Candy trying to explain that it was okay that they were hitting on the girls? And again, this predates Judge Judy by like a decade and a half. But the sassy black woman judge is also kind of trying to judge Judy it up. And she's like, so you were making advances to a woman who is clearly involved with another man. Right. None of that has anything to do with what
I know. Like, now it's more of like, okay, this is clearly from 1906. Like, oh, you're a bad moral character, huh? And you got,
Maybe that line is left from when it was like a vaudeville play. Yeah. And they were like, the candy striper said that. We had, anyway, I'm just going to keep throwing in like old timey words.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's comedy.
All right. So, but then stereotypical.
We have to add in that from the beginning, there has been a man photographing Brewster. And Brewster, of course, suspects, well, that's got to be a scout looking to hire a 45-year-old pitcher to the major leagues.
Right.
And you come to find out, so they don't have the bail money, as you said, and now they're stuck in jail. How are they going to get out? Well, that guy who was photographing him bails him out. And it turns out the lawyers who are in charge of the estate of his crazy uncle that's going to do this whole thing, they hired a private detective to track down a guy who's played minor league baseball for 15 years. Like, that's not a tough case. Like, just go to a game.
This is another one of these that, like, instantly, as the second you think about it as a plot device, you're like, well, that makes no sense, right?
Yeah,
like,
just because, write him a letter. It's 1985. Yeah. What do you just look him up?
It's the executor, of his uncle's will, and the law firm that is going to probate it, and. You don't need and there's a line about how like he's been following each of Brewster's last four starts or whatever. Like, why? There's no, like, no
you have to
no
know that's critical
to
the law. You see, if you're gonna somebody leaves you some money, they have to check the box scores to make sure. What? I don't understand. I can't even. It's the dumbest thing.
They don't even care.
God, I hate this. I hate watching movies like this. I don't know why you did this to me.
So the PI bails him out, drives them to New York. There's a comedy bit where they're like trying to figure out, is it the Yankees or the Mets? And as it turns out, it's the law firm. And I guess the other comedy bit here is supposed to be that Richard Pryor's great uncle, Rupert Horn, is Hume Cronin, who, you know, Hume Cronin has been 100 years old. He's probably still alive now, right? Like,
I don't know.
He's been 100 years old for forever. Well, it's that
I'll
guy.
Look it up now. Yeah. Hume Cronin.
Hume Cronin.
Yeah, I see it. You know. Born 1911. I'm going to go ahead and guess. Not alive. But Canadian actor, son of a well-known Ontario politician. Interesting.
He's been in everything. And he's like one of those actors that's, right, he always plays the old guy. Like, even when you're like, oh, well, let's watch this movie from 1973. And you're like, oh, Hume Cronin's the old guy. And, oh, let's watch this movie from the 40s. Yep. You know, Hume Cronin plays the deceased grandfather. So anyway, so Hume Cronin. And here we get the central conceit of the movie. We teased a little bit of this. It's this crazy will. I'm going to deconstruct the bad law in a minute. I will say, I don't know if you did this, Thomas, but I looked up because the clause is he can take $1 million now, or he can take $30 million. He's got to spend it in 30 days with, and then we'll talk about the conditions. And if he does that, then he inherits $300 million. And the movie plays that having $30 million makes him like the richest man in New York. Right.
Yeah.
So I think $300 million would make him, you know, the Sultan of Brunei. Right.
Yeah. That's a lot. 300. I mean, and it's funny because you look at the original plots from 1906. Yeah. And it's like, well, he inherited $15, but if he can spend 40, you know, whatever, it's like nothing. I think the 300 million number is 1 million. So wait, how is it Brewster's millions then? Was it Brewster's million or did maybe he had to spend? Now I want to know.
Maybe get $2 million.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to look at the plot.
Spend all these hay pennies within 30 days.
Oh no! Sorry, I got okay. I was slightly inaccurate. So it's 1 million, but the other offering is 4 million, provided he spends the 1 million given by. And originally it was 2. Oh, that's way better. Why did you redo this? Okay. The 1921 film says it's 2 grandfathers. And then I think I don't know. There's some sort of feud between them. And so one grandfather says, I'll give you $1 million. And then the other says, I'll give you $4 million if you spend the entire $1 million by the other grandfather because he doesn't want him to have that money. That makes way more sense.
Yeah, that does. That
all right.
And plus,
they could have done the gimmick where it's like one is black and one is white. Could have added some racism in there, you know, like just
well,
for fun.
There'll be some racism in here.
Yeah, I know. But like it could have been a racist feud, you know, part of it.
Yep.
But anyway, I do want to add one more thing on the name. Who's the actor? I already can't remember. Hume Cronin. I noticed on his list is The Pelican Brief, which we haven't done, right?
We have not.
He's in The Pelican Brief. So note to us. We can see Hume Cronin again if we would like to.
Yay, another 3-hour John Grisham movie.
In a future Lot Alpha movie.
So, all right. So I did. I don't know if you did this.
Oh, God,
one.
You're right. It's 2 hours and 22 minutes. Never mind. Yeah. I take that all back.
I looked up inflation, how much $30 million is in 2019 dollars. And
oh, wow. That's going
to turns
be like
out.
A lot, right?
No, turns out just inflation-wise, it's just 70 million, right? So it would be 70 and 700 million. So what that shows you is that
double, like that's
that. Yeah, but it shows you that income inequality has risen way faster than.
Oh right, yeah,
yeah. Than inflation. So because it's clearly right, like when he gets the three. Not to spoil anything. If he gets the 300 million, the movie plays it like he's going to be a billionaire, right? Like he's going to be Jeff Bezos.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
but 700 million would not put you on the list.
Oh, no. Yeah, you're not in the top. But, yeah, that's true. You're not in the barely write home about that.
Right. So here are the conditions, right? He can hire anybody he wants, but he has to get value for their services. He can, you know, donate away 5%, gamble 5%. You must not destroy that which is inherently valuable. You can't tell anyone. And I think this is an implied codicil in the will that I'm just going to assume got read in a scene change. Each wacky shenanigan you do, you can only do once.
Oh, right? Yeah. And yeah, because this is, I love how they made some attempt to like tie up the loose ends. But I'm sitting here just thinking there's going to be an easy loophole to any of this that they don't do. Right. I mean, you get hire one guy, which you get value for $30 million. You're done.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the thing. Like, you could put in, this is the first of the bad law. You could put in, it has to be fair market value for the services, but then none of the hiring that Brewster does in the whole movie, spoiler, is going to be fair market.
They should have done that, and then he just has to hire a lot more people. But it is really not that difficult to spend a bunch of money. My, you want to hear, maybe we can alternate pitches for the easiest cheat code on this.
Okay. Like, yeah.
And we'll
even
make it hard.
I think is the fun part of the movie. Right?
Yeah.
Is the trying to.
Is
you're
anything
watching
but
going,
watching the movie?
Yeah. Well, you're watching going, how
is
would
researching
I?
Researching Fatty Arbuckle and how he got screwed by the justice system? Yeah. No, I agree.
I have my own deep dive or mini deep dive I did right on this one here. So
I was thinking, it's possible that in 1985, this wouldn't quite do the trick. But my first instinct, though, let's say you have to get market value, basically. So it's not, you know, you can't do the easy thing of just hiring somebody for way too much. I was like, well, buy like what, however many it would be, one, anywhere from 1 to 5 Super Bowl ads and you're done. Day one spent, money spent. You don't have an asset. You do an ad for something that gives you no value, by the way. You can't like direct anybody to buy anything. It's got to be, you just like
yeah, but
vote.
The Super Bowl would have to be in that 30-day period.
Why? I pay in advance. Is that
no?
Part of the
but
rules?
Then you would. But then you would own the asset when
oh,
you were
that,
done.
Okay, you know
of
what?
A future ad.
You know what? I accept that correction. That's a good point. So it really depends on when this takes place. Okay, if it's not in Super Bowl, the month before Super Bowl,
yeah.
Then that doesn't work. That's fair.
My thought, and this is slightly shamelessly ripped off from. Well, you'll see when I give you the pitch, but was go and bankroll like the worst possible movie you could imagine. Right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Find like
we can make more from a flop than we can from a hit.
but you know, find like the like takeover, be like, we're going to do Apocalypse Now 2, right? And just, you know, say, all right, everything.
I think you'll very
be...
quickly run into the exact same plot line as the producers. It turns out to be a hit, and then you're stuck.
It could be. But I'm thinking you could blow the $30 million in 30
but
days
I,
and then just
I
have to close up shop with no movie left. So
another quick quibble. Let's say legal question, Andrew, and I do want you to spell out like what percentage of any of this could be actually a legal thingy. But could you just be like, all right, I don't want the $1 million. That's not enough for me. But the $300 million, maybe just hypothetically, you're like, well, maybe there's some risk that obviously somebody's going to screw me over on this, or I'll this. So I don't want to blow all the money. Why don't I just spend the $30 million and just accumulate a bunch of assets and then be like, oh, whoops, I lost. And then I just have all the $30 million in assets and money that, you know what I mean? Like just take the $30 million. Is there some way they would stop you from doing that?
Presumably, like you could have a liquidated damages clause in it that says, you know, if you don't spend the money, right, that you have to pay back, you know, whatever as liquidated damages.
All right, fair.
But
but what, how much of this, what are the limits of like these, you know, restrictions you can put on inheritance?
I'm glad you asked because that
is the
segues
show.
It, that is the show. It segues into a little bit of my medium dive that I did, which was, which had
it's
to
about
do with
Buster Keaton.
Yeah, no, kind of. Sorry. It has to do with a famous Iowa attorney named T.M. Zink, Z-I-N-K, who died in 1930. And his will, when he died, specified that it would disinherit his wife and his daughter. His wife, this is great. His daughter would receive $5. His wife would be allowed to remain in the marital home, provided that she paid fair market rent, to stay in the house.
Who is she paying rent to? The estate?
To the landlord. Right.
Okay.
Because apparently they were just renting that.
Oh,
that house.
Okay. Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. So it was like,
well, then how is it even his to give?
Right. It was exactly. He's like, so I bequeath to my wife the right to pay rent to stay in this house. The rest of his estate was set to be invested for 75 years, where Zink calculated that it would appreciate in value to be the sum of $4 million, which would then be used to endow a library. But this wouldn't just be any library. This would be the Thomas M. Zink Womanless Library. I am not making this up.
Oh, my God.
The condition
Isn't that just
was,
any library in the before the yeah. year, whatever?
The condition was, quote, no woman shall at any time, under any pretense or for any purpose, be allowed inside the library or upon the premises or have any say about anything concerned therewith, nor appoint any person or persons to perform any act connected therewith, nor no book, work of art, chart, magazine, picture, unless some production by a man shall be allowed inside or outside the building or upon the premises. And this shall include all decorations for inside
this
and outside
is
the building.
True dedication to misogyny, like taking it beyond, like even if I was a misogynist, I'd be like, all right, well, when I die, like, all right, I'll kind of let go of it. Who cares? No, this guy wants misogyny to the grave and beyond.
There shall be, over each entrance to the premises and the building, a sign in these words, no woman admitted. It is my intention to forever exclude all women from the premises and having anything to say or do with the trust, estate, and library. So it's not hard to imagine what happened next. You want to take a guess at that?
What happened next? When?
Yeah, so Zink died. Those were the terms of his will.
Perhaps his wife and daughter sued? I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, his daughter, Margretta, had him declared of unsound mind, as evidence the fact that his will was fucking crazy.
And then the judge at the time was like, I don't see any problem with it. Seems fine to me.
No, she actually won.
Oh, okay.
The court gave everything to her. And so there is no TM Zink Womanless Library in Iowa.
It'd be funny to if there were. I mean, it's horrible, but it'd also be kind of funny. I'll be honest, just that somebody was that big of an asshole. Like, it'd just be hilarious.
The model for some of have you seen Major League? Speaking of, you know.
No.
Really?
Sorry.
You should watch Major League.
I think I've seen parts of it on TV 1,000 times and then never the whole thing.
There is zero law in the movie, so we can't. Well, there's breaking the lease, but it would be even more tenuous than when we did The Running Man. But maybe you will do it as a present to me someday. Major League is great, and it is hilarious, and everybody loves it. And the villain in Major Leagues is an ex showgirl named Rachel Phelps. And other than the showgirl part, which they added because it was the 80s and, you know, you needed a little bit of that. She was based on Leona Helmsley, who owned, I think, a majority interest, certainly a controlling share of the Cincinnati Reds. When Leona Helmsley died, she left, I believe, $12 million to her dog. So anyway, rich people do stupid things with their money. If you really wanted to try and do this though, you wouldn't put it in a will. You would have, some kind of a living trust because the problem is that wills are probated, right? So they're read publicly and there would be no way to like hide the conditions from everybody else. Although I guess the way they write around that is by saying that, the Hume Cronin had no more living descendants, but you know, but like people show up out of the woodwork when a billionaire dies. So,
right.
So that would be a little bit of a problem, but anyway, he tells this little, I'm not even going to tell the story about like smoking cigars and the,
oh God.
Yeah. It's kind of stupid. And then we set up the not mathematically viable evil plot device.
Hold on, I have a note. It just says, man, this sucks. I just want to chime in.
Okay. Well, sucks. You know. the not viable plot device is, you see, if Brewster loses, then the law firm here, Granville and Baxter, which admittedly is a pretty 80s name for a law firm, Granville and Baxter would then administer the estate in a charitable fashion, which is true, for a fee, for a considerable fee, as the executor says, which is probably less true. But, like, you know what? It's going to be like a couple, like, the most egregious you could do would be a couple million dollars of administering the trust, and like it would not be remotely worth
all the federal crimes they're about to commit. I gotta say a couple things. So is there a reason this was all in cash? Because they go to the bank and there is a Breaking Bad cube of cash sitting there. And that it was that part of it? I didn't hear that in the rules, but anyway, whatever. And then this is so fucking stupid. This makes even less sense in 1985 than it would now. Because then, oh wait, is that true? No, I might have it backwards, but still, it makes no sense. The bank manager, whoever, rushes to, I can't remember his name. It's Brewster. What's his name again?
Yeah, God, Monty Brewster.
Richard Pryor. God, I don't know why I blanked on that. Rushes to Richard Pryor and is like, all right, well, we'll give you our Arabian King rate, which is 24% interest. 24%. I want to know what the bank is using his money to do if they can offer 24% interest. So this must just be Bernie Madoff pyramid schemes incorporated. Like, kind of, we just dump it straight into a pyramid scheme that doubles our money every time. How 24% interest?
Yeah, I had
the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
I had that they must be financing Pablo Escobar with the money, but I will point out it is New York, so it could be proto Bernie Madoff. I like that. So, the 24% interest was ridiculous, and obviously every time Brewster is set to make money, right, he's got to Richard Pryor it up and be like, no, I should pay you money. I'm renting the space from you, right? So,
yeah, I do have that wrong, which is interest rates were quite high in the 80s. I don't know why I reversed that in my mind, but still.
They were in the early 80s, but still nobody was making 24%
for putting their money in a bank.
Right. Oh, and we elided over the fact we alluded to it in the intro, but the law firm assigns a paralegal from the accounting department. Right.
Yeah.
Which is like hiring a lawyer from the mechanic shop. Right. Like, I mean, it's those are two different jobs, and nobody in this movie thought about how they weren't two different jobs. But anyway,
it doesn't even matter. Like, they could have just
said we're assigning you an accountant, but yeah, anyway,
and the idea that like there's any chance she could possibly keep up with every dollar spent, like he's just going around
in an
nonstop.
Era before computers.
Yeah,
I mean, well, not before computers, but before personal computers, right? Before
right,
handheld.
You'd have to assume she's like tape recording him. And then, like, going back and translating it, because it's impossible. Cash. Yep. He's just going around throwing cash at people all day, but whatever.
And we get kind of our first sort of cross-cutting of him throwing around cash, which includes a delightful scene where he's got to borrow a quarter to call, they're not really clear on this. Like, he says he's borrowed the quarter to call his old baseball manager, right, Lenny, Jerry Orbach. But then Jerry Orbach says, you called me collect.
Yeah.
Which don't have to pay the quarter, but that's just there so we can see some more baseballing, which features a great line. I would say the funniest lines in this movie probably come from Jerry Orbach, right? So while he's trying to talk to Brewster on the phone, he's screaming out like, hey, Gonzalez, you're not a farmer. You don't have to swing at shit in the dirt, which is totally a thing that some of my coaches would have said to me if they had thought about it.
My favorite line is when we meet the accountant's husband. So let me know when that is.
Mm.
Are we there somewhere?
We're close. Right. Close. So, okay. All right. So then, we cross cut away. We of course get a Yakov Smirnoff, cameo because it's the 80s.
Oh, we did. I completely missed that. What was that?
He's the cab driver.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
Yakov Smirnov is the cab driver. So
now I see it, but that's such an obscure for somebody who wasn't really conscious in the 80s. That's man. Just looked like a zany 80s movie character.
Well, and remember, like,
that's his whole bit. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, like, look, America, what a country, right? Like, that was it. And so Monty Brewster's out there, like, he can hire people. So he's hiring everybody he meets, you know, to do stuff. So he hires the bank security guard to be his chief of security. And he hires the PI to be his personal photographer. And yeah. And so he hires the first cab driver he comes across to be his personal limousine driver. And it's Yakov Smirnov who says, America, what a country. You have to hire
and
piece
you know
of
what?
Shit cab.
This is so easy. It's even easier than I thought. Let's even assume all the strictest possible version of all these rules. Well, what's the definition of getting value, of market value? Because couldn't you just make a quick pyramid of, hey, I'm going to pay you. You hire two guys to hire two guys. Very quickly, you run out of the money, probably instantly, because exponentially, like they just hire two guys to hire two guys to hire two guys. It's gone.
Yep.
Right?
I mean, easily. Yep. No, you'd have to have, like, to make it work, you'd have to have fair market value, and you would have to have a personal transaction with them, right? Like, you would have to you have to consume the service yourself, which, again, would eliminate all of the,
I already got it. Here's what you do. You walk out the door. In 5 minutes, you give, literally, you give half the money to two people and say, here's what you're going to do. You're each going to find two people to give half the money, and so on until you get to like $10, you know, which won't be that long actually because it's exponential. And you're all hiring each other. All you're doing is hiring people to perform a street routine for me where you're all going to like skip and I'm going to watch it. So I'm getting the value and then we're done. It's all done that instant. And if anybody runs away with it, that's not his fault. Maybe they don't even, you know, they just stole the money from him. He's not liable for that. Done. Movie.
All right. Well, I have to put some kind of clause in my will to make sure no one does that. All right.
Yeah.
So there's running around throwing money at people. There's the restaurant scene, which is, again, in my view, the funniest line in the movie, where he's talking to the snooty maitre d', and he's like, "Yeah, we want 200 people in at $200 a head, and also you guys got wine." And he's like, "Yeah." And he's like, "What's the most expensive bottle of wine you have?" He's like, "Oh, that's the Chateau Lafitte 1961. It is $200 a bottle." And and Brewster turns around to the crowd and goes, "You guys like Lafitte?" Which is just, love that. It's just great. By the way, Chateau Lafitte 1961, not remotely one of the best bottles of Lafitte. It's $1,800 a bottle today, though, so you still would have done well had you bought it at $200 a bottle back then. The 82, Chateau Lafitte 82 is $4,000 a bottle. So there you go. And now here's where we get to meet the accountant's fiance who comes out of the Titanic school of typecasting.
Yeah.
We already got the accountant saying and he's a sincere feminist. And so, you know, it's the 1980s, so you know he's going to be the villain.
Which is funny because for a while he's like a super cool dude. But I think back then it would have been, you know, like he would have been perceived a little differently. Because for me, I was like, oh, I love this guy. Until later on they make him like obviously evil. Also, he is Clark Kent, right? What's the actor's name? The original Superman? Not the original, but, you know, the Superman from the 80s. What the hell is that guy's name? Anyway, he looks a lot like that guy. And now I can't get that. Yeah.
Christopher Reeve.
Yeah. He looks a lot like that guy.
Except blonde hair, not quite as built, but I can see that. That's a little. I think it's because of the big glasses that he has.
He looks like he's disguised as Clark Kent.
Yes. That's exactly right.
And so I love it too because he comes in and he's this all like reasonable guy. He's talking about this. Oh, go ahead.
You finish, please.
No. What were you going to say?
He is donating his legal services to the Committee Against Boxing, Football, and Ice Hockey.
Pretty funny. And then he's like, "Well, we've got to get to this. You know, we've got to get to this benefit." This is the one thing I actually laughed at because He like is such a so straight laced in his delivery. I actually thought it was pretty funny because he's like, oh, a benefit, you know, whatever. And so of course, Richard Pryor is going to try to find a way to give him some money. So he's like, you know, oh, what? Why don't I hire you or donate or one or the other? I can't remember. I'll give you, you know, all this money, like 200. Oh, maybe it's when he says, well, whatever. He's going to give him a bunch of money. And, of course, the wife is annoyed because she's annoyed at this whole thing. She's annoyed that Richard Pryor is blowing all this money because she doesn't know the secret plot thing. And so she's like trying to get rid of him. He's like, all right, darling, don't we have to go to the benefit? And then Clark Kent's like, well, darling, this is what the benefit is for, to raise money. So in a sense, we're at the benefit right now. That was like my only line that I laughed at because it was just like so straight laced.
Yeah, that's a good line. We have another good Jerry Orbach line coming up in a minute. But yeah, so that sets up like the two different, you know, kind of conflicts that are in the movie, I guess you might say, right? So the one is Richard Pryor is really, really into the accountant. And she thinks he's a total jerk because he's spending all the money frivolously. And
they, you know, they do not in any way. And this is a real 80s movie thing. There is no fucking reason for him to be interested in her, or let alone for her to be interested in him. Zero.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Zero.
No. And they have less than no chemistry.
Oh,
on
yeah.
screen. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's
zero.
Bad.
Chemistry.
It's bad. So his internal conflict is, I look like an asshole in front of this woman who's, you know, super liberal and wants him to spend his money on, you know, endowing charitable causes. But he can't do that because he can only give a little bit away to charity and he can't, you know, have any permanent assets. So and then the second conflict is her husband is a junior partner at Granville and Baxter. And is then, but is also his ex-wife was an interior designer,
yeah.
And so he's like really smart about interior design. So Brewster hires him to be his interior designer,
yeah, to redecorate the hotel room.
The hotel in? Room, yeah. It's you don't think about okay. that one too hard.
Sure.
Apparently, if you make enough money, you can just redecorate a hotel that you're staying in for a month. But and then the firm, so he's got to go take a leave of absence for a month from the firm. He's being paid $250,000 to do that. So the partners are like, you know, you could be our eyes and ears for us,
mm-hmm.
Which quickly, like it is kind of like there were two writes of the script, right? Like, because there's like 20 minutes where he's just sort of reporting back, like, you know, doing what you would for your employer, right? Like, oh, you asked me to see, is this guy wasting money? And yeah, he's wasting tons of money. And then they're like, all right, well, we're going to bring you in with the evil conspiracy now, mm-hmm. Which we'll get to. But all right, so that sets up that. Then
so as they leave, by the way, we get Brewster for no reason breaking the fourth wall in a movie that doesn't break the fourth wall in any other
right.
time. He just says to the camera, like, oh, what an asshole or something. I don't even know what it is. But it was like, what are you doing? What are you people doing? What is this?
Yeah. It really was it was a direct fourth wall break.
Direct
it was
into
like,
the
yeah,
camera.
Yeah,
one
yeah,
time.
I hate that guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it was, in case this wasn't clear in the scene we just had, I'm going to say this one time and one time only, and then we'll do the rest of the movie without doing that. Weird.
Yep. Yep. So we have a couple of schemes going on. Right. So, you know, Brewster's spending money, but like it's not enough to just, you know, throw fancy parties and buy wine and all of that. So the first thing he does is he sets up offices and he's going to be essentially like a venture capitalist. Right. Mm. And the idea, again, this is, you know, the producers kind of thing, like he's going to fund really terrible business ventures and then lose all the money.
Which is risky, though, because they have to fail within the 30 days.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a terrible idea. Right. Yeah. So the first one, and don't think too hard about this one, is the iceberg company that is going to take public domain icebergs from the North Pole, drop motors, drive them all the way to the Middle East and
the
eat
water.
The profits.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so Brewster invests $1 million into the iceberg company. right? Like that's years in it to go, right? He just has a toy iceberg right now, right? Like he does not. Yeah. Anyway,
yeah. From conception to execution, that business idea is going to take longer than 30 days. I think is what you're saying.
Right.
To by the way, to then losing all the money.
Right. But not in this movie. It does not. Yeah. But then his other idea, and this is kind of like my movie idea, right? Like it's kind of a clever idea. He's like, okay, well, what I'm going to do is my baseball team, the Hackensack Bulls, I'm going to pay to have an exhibition game against the New York Yankees.
By the way, probably could have just used up all the $30 million right there. Done and done.
Yeah, probably. But, you know.
Even in 1985, maybe.
Even in 1985. But nevertheless, that's the... Do you remember...
Is this where we saw the Rick Moranis cameo?
Oh, yeah. No, in the offices.
That was crazy. Because, like, I saw him and I was like, is that Rick Moranis? Because it just goes to show... Beards make everybody look better. He had a beard. And so I was trying to do the math. I was like, this couldn't have been his first thing, but he looks different than anything else I've ever seen him in. And I was like, he's barely even mentioned. Like, it's just a tiny cameo. But it was like after Ghostbusters 1, but like before some other movies he did. Like, he hadn't done a lot, but it was just kind of weird.
I honestly think he was just... Hanging out. Coke with John Candy, right? because they go back to SCTV days, right? So, Canadians got to stick together. And, and so I think like they were just there. And John Candy
actually was kind of the only other funny part of it. Why don't you wander through and do Stickola?
No,
he's just like, he just does impressions, but like he does like 2 second impressions of everybody for just repeats what they say.
It is. He does the I can repeat you game, right? Yeah, that's it. Then we get there's a bit about flying in the baseball team and whatever. You don't need, no one cares about that. But then we see the team actually working out at the practice field. And this is actually like the workouts are like the best sportsing in the movie because they're not comically bad at it, right? Like that they're, but they don't look great. Right.
But also, I mean, I had the note, can't wait for this one baseball practice to make them professional baseball players.
Yeah. Well,
they're all practicing like fielding and stuff. You just need to be able to hit their professional pitchers. That's all that matters. The fielding. I mean, what difference is that going to make? They're all going to crank home runs on you and you would have to crank home runs too somehow. It's weird. Should have been just. Infinite batting practice.
All batting practice. Well, anyway, we see him taking infield practice and they look good, but not like major league good. And the movie plays that straight and is like, well, they usually look better than that. Right. And there's another great line from Jerry Orbach as the coach going, oh yeah, that's a hell of a throw there. That's Tinkers to Evers to shit. which that's a great line. Anyway, then we get more because that is not enough baseball. We see Richard Pryor and John Candy having a catch in the hotel.
Yeah, I also liked that just because it was like, oh, this is a total 80s movie thing. Yeah. Whereas a kid, you're like, oh, I wish I could play baseball on it. Inside, be awesome.
Yeah, and it's that right. That's meant to be that kind of cavalier. But like, boy, when you watch, like, they're standing like 12 feet apart from each other. They have the Foley guy like editing the sounds of like M80s going off for when the ball hits into John Candy's glove, because otherwise it would just make this like soft little like noise. So instead he like loops this like long slow pitch in, and you hear this like flam.
Now is this before or after? Apologies, get a little vain on you people, but is this before or after Richard Pryor is with a beautiful woman with we don't know the origins of, like, it's implied maybe it's a prostitute or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. This is right at the time.
Beautiful woman, 70,000 times more attractive than the accountant girl who is for no reason is the love interest. And then he like gets rid of her in order to see the married, not interested in him accountant girl. I was just like, what are you?
Yep.
Why? What are we doing? Why?
Yep.
Switch those two.
Yeah, no, totally. I am 100% on board with all of that. And also, that is the scene where they bring in John Candy, as Spike Nolan has set up, is using the accountant because he knows that Richard Pryor is with the other woman. And so he's like, oh, I'll appeal to you by getting the accountant to get you to come out. And all of that is to bring in Arnold T. Pants. Arnold T. Pants, the lawyer from Fletch, is here as the accountant.
Oh,
the investment advisor.
I kind of chuckled at this because this whole thing was like, he gives the pitch of like, I only make money if you make money. It's 15% on the whatever. And then, of course, Pryor, who's needs to get rid of the money, is like, how about I just give you $1 million? And he's like, and John Candy is like, no, you don't get it. That's not how he does it. And the guy's like, well, I'll make an exception in this case.
right. Yeah. In your case, I'll make an exception. Yeah. So put a pin in that because that will come back later. Now we get on to the next scheme to get rid of money, is that Richard Pryor is going to go out and he is going to buy the rarest stamp in the world. This is the inverted Jenny. You've all seen it. It's the one with the like biplane that's upside down. He pays $1.25 million for it. And then the gag is, obviously that's an asset, but then he mails it.
Well, you know, and then the gag is the stupidest fucking thing in the world, which is the evil lawyers are following him along on TV and newspaper or whatever. And they're like,
yeah, they're watching him.
He just bought a stamp, which is, of course, an asset. Good luck getting rid of that. He'll be stuck with it forever. We win. And then the mail comes in, of course. Yeah. I saw this coming a billion miles away. Yeah. Oh, he used the stamp, which wouldn't, I mean... I guess so that's technically not destroying it, but it just becomes worthless once you've... I still don't even think it would be worthless once you've mailed it, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, absolutely. That it would then be worthless.
It would reduce the value, but now it's still the inverted Jenny, but with some crap on it. That's not $0.
Yeah, but it's not in his possession anymore. It's now in... Right?
But like, if those are the rules, why can't he give $30 million to the first person he sees?
Well, because he uses it for its intended purposes.
That's how it gets around everything. Because he used it, he got some amount of value on it. Okay, this is not the market value rules. I got it.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, the inverted Jenny may be worth $1 million today. Definitely not worth $1 million back then. So he's also, overpaid. But, and now we get to the first of the... of the architectural redesigns of the offices inside the hotel.
Which is just 80s as fuck.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this is the postmodern fantasy, and it looks kind of like it's halfway between, like, a Bennigan's and, like, the old Las Vegas, the, like, 1970s-style Las Vegas-themed casinos. It is just with the club from Terminator sort of thrown in for color. Like it's awful. It's truly one of the worst designs I have ever seen. We get that, and then we get a little more back and forth. And this is the line where all of a sudden the lawyer goes from being just sort of caught up in this to being unquestionably evil, right? He's talking to his ex-wife and she's like, ugh, after all the things you've done to try and improve her. You there?
Yeah. After what? I was trying to follow along.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
After all the things.
They're chatting. They look out the window. Sorry. Edit. But
We're not editing. So,
okay, yeah. We're not editing. Well, our patrons get to hear us go behind the scenes.
What was the punchline there? I didn't respond. Here's the punchline.
So the lawyer and the designer ex-wife are looking out the window at Richard Pryor and the accountant having an argument, which somehow they've mistaken as flirting. Like,
oh yeah,
yeah. And the designer says, ugh, after all the things you've done to try and improve her. Which again is this just like Titanic level dialogue of right. Like, do you not have a mustache you can twirl here or something? But Yeah. Then we cut back away, and Arnold T. Pants, if you stop me if you didn't see this coming, has made Monty Brewster $10 million, right? By having Spike buy certain things, and because we get the entire movie, this is the biggest trope of the, like, KXP, all exposition TV all the time, right? Like,
I have the same note. He tuned into Solution to Your Problems television.
Yeah. And it is the world's, even in 1985, the world's most ridiculous political op-ed, in which they're like, this station is unable to endorse either of the candidates for mayor because all they do is spend their money on attack ads. And I actually took that. And the only question is whether the city of New York is for sale and just how much slush money it will take to buy it.
Yeah. Just how much inheritance money of somebody needs to get rid of in this movie it will take.
So this movie is the Michael Bloomberg story, right? Like,
yeah,
we know how much it will take. Michael Bloomberg was mayor.
Or who's
of New York.
The guy? Who's the other candidate? Now I'm blanking. There's another candidate that truly just did the "I will give you a dollar if you donate a dollar to my campaign." Who was that?
I'm blanking. Did Meg Whitman do that? I know.
No,
Meg
no.
Whitman
this year.
This year. Okay.
One of the Democrats. He's the guy.
Oh,
who did
is that
like,
Tom? Is that Tom Steyer?
Is it Tom Steyer? I don't think it is. I think it's that other guy. Anyway, it's one of them. Sorry, but that's the thing.
Yeah. So then we smash cut away, and Monty is going to run for mayor. This is more bad law. It's only 10 days before the election, so
yeah, good time to declare your candidacy.
That's too late to declare your candidacy and get on the ballot. But we get an 80s newspaper montage. We get little spinny newspers.
We get some people loading up a gigantic blank newspaper roll for no reason.
We do.
Because they're like, hold on, turn on the spinny newspaper thing. And then, like, in the behind the scenes, they're like, we're out of spinny newspaper. Load up another ream on the spinny newspaper machine. And they're like, okay, we'll film this for some reason. And then they do it. And then... Weird.
Yeah, it was definitely a paper loader guy does one take, right?
Like, yeah,
but then we cut away. So this is clearly a good idea of how to waste money. We go back to the law firm and the lawyers. Did you notice that there's this weird thing where they look at each other and they're like, he's running ads in all 52 states.
Wait,
just in
what?
Case any New Yorkers are on vacation, right? And so it's meant to be the joke about the end. Yeah, they say 52 states.
I'd miss that.
I have no idea what to make of it. It's
wow.
It's right. Just weird. It's, I don't know.
It's almost like a lot of there wasn't much oversight in this movie. Like when Richard Pryor spoke directly in the camera once for no reason.
Yeah.
It's almost like there wasn't a good, coherent, like, directed,
continuity,
direction,
yeah, continuity yeah, editor,
editing,
yeah, right.
Yeah. They're just like, whatever, go with it. But and yet, this movie was like a $30-40 million budget or something. So,
oh yeah.
But I guess that all went to, like Brewster, it all went to bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. It all went up Richard Pryor's nose. And so, you know, and then they do this thing that like would be kind of charming if Donald Trump weren't the goddamn president, right? Like
I know things like this used to be funnier and like, oh yeah, mess up the system, get in
right,
there,
yeah, come in and
tell
blow
them
it up
all and how those candidates all suck and don't vote for anybody. After 2016, it's like, no, don't do
no,
that.
The yeah, system like let's yeah, the system's amazing.
Just very
and
much find
out.
A good candidate and right. Vote for them. Instead.
Did you have you seen Dave? That's Kevin Kline.
Yes, but yeah. Not for a long time.
And again, that's a good movie. I think it's a good movie anyway. But like, sure. Kevin Kline is awesome. I mean, since I was
Kevin
Kline's
great.
Know,
come on,
Fish Called Wanda. Right,
Fish Called Wanda. Right. Literally, I think he won an Oscar for that.
I sure hope so because he was great in that.
Yeah,
Nietzsche's
so great.
Yeah. So anyway, like, so Dave has that, Bullworth has it. Bullworth was terrible, but like, right. Lots of movies have had that conceit of like, oh, if only we could have an outsider who wasn't afraid to tell it like it is. And right. And that's going to be what, you know, Brewster does here. We get another montage. This is a spending money montage.
When's the last time? 'Cause this is absolutely true. not only was it nominated, Fish Called Wanda, because I don't care about this stupid movie, was nominated for Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and winning Best Supporting Actor. When's the last time, like, just a great written comedy, you know, like, had that much? Does that happen anymore? It feels to me like the only Oscar stuff is the serious, you know, kind of, you know? The movie was so good that, like, imagine winning Best Supporting Actor for a comedy role like that. Does that happen still?
Well, other than Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny.
Right. Well, that's similar time period, right?
Similar. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But
doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, comedies have it rough. So I'm with you.
Or they're just not good anymore. Yeah, one or the other. I don't know.
That's true, too. So, yeah. Then I'm going to skip the, like, crazy nonsensical meeting between the two mayoral candidates where why that doesn't need to be, but now we get to go to the big game,
the big game.
And first, like, I have to say, I legitimately laughed. We didn't talk about this in the initial game. We see the Hackensack field has a, because it's the lowest levels of the minors, so they have a train that runs through the outfield. Which,
yeah, I know.
Look like,
there's not really, there isn't a field that a minor league team could play on that doesn't have a train going through it.
I, you know,
kind of think not.
You wouldn't, because right.
How many fucking blown knees and ankles would there be on that thing?
You wouldn't. But nevertheless, it means so that when they actually play the Yankees and they've renovated the field and it's like all spruced up and everything, but like they still have the train in the outfield. And so the Brewster campaign train comes through. And I legitimately laughed at that. Maybe I'm a terrible person, but I laughed at that.
I don't know about a terrible person. I just, what's funny about it? Sorry. I missed it.
There's a train running through the outfield. Anyway. Okay. So, like, I get it that you're skeptical. It's fine. You could be fine.
Right, fine. Fine. Sure.
And then
I laughed when some meth addict catches a ball at the fence. Because again, for some reason, I still don't understand this. The whole thing is, Brewster thinks again, like he thinks he's a good player, and I don't know what the movie intends, but he's like, I can shut out anyone for three innings. It's like, well, the fucking Yankees, though. And then the way he's doing well is, once again, people are cranking the fuck out of home runs, but they either go just foul or they're just over the fence for some reason. And anyway, despite the fact that throwing 40 miles an hour at a major leaguer, he would just crush it 700 feet over all the trains in the area. But whatever. I don't get it.
They, as you point out, I have the same note, right? Because they have the batter crush the ball, and then they cut over to the, like, the center fielder jumping up and catching it right at the wall.
Yeah.
Except that, like, the continuity edit is so bad, right? Like, it's like those YouTube videos where, like, you know, the kid throws the basketball over his shoulder and then, like, you cut over to a different gym of, like, the basketball swishing through the hoop. Like,
yeah, he runs, by the way, he was, for some reason, he was really crowding the infield on this Yankee. He was like, well, I think we need some more reinforcement. He shifted up into basically the infield. And then the outfielder runs a quarter mile to get somehow the ball just really must have gone straight up in the air. And then he goes, like you said, cuts over and he does the catch over the fence.
Yep. But I did like, the other thing I really, really enjoyed about the baseball scene was they have I think they must have been the actual, if they're not the actual Yankees announcers from the 80s, and I don't know because I hate the fucking Yankees, but if not, they do the perfect impression of New Yorkers, right, announcing the Yankee game, because they're like utterly serious about it. Like, they're playing, you know, a low A independent team, and they're like, well, and there's where you see New York Yankee power. And it's just like, and it is exactly, it is so dumb, but it is 100%. I could hear Michael Kay doing that right now. Like, if I got together like a team, like Alex's old, you know, like 16U team, and put together the money for them to play a 3-inning exhibition game against the Yankees, like Michael Kay would be like, and the Yankees win, the Yankees win. And you'd be like, oh, shut the fuck up, dude. Like, but yeah, so I hate the Yankees. I'm losing patrons on this, but I don't care. I hate the Yankees. And they also do have this great line where Brewster throws in the pitch, and the announcer's like, "So, guess that's a changeup, huh?" And you, yeah. And you hear Spike be like, "Well, that's his fastball." Like, you know, that one was good. I like that. So, so big game. Bulls are ahead 1-0 for a while, and then
they skipped the part where somehow that shitty piece of shit team scored on a major league pitcher. I would have liked to see that, but they skip it.
I'm going with all the action happens off screen. I'm going with walk, 2 stolen bases, and scores on a wild pitch.
Is that more or less likely? That yeah, I don't know. I don't even know.
That's my headcanon.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe like just the so out of sorts having to pitch on this weird place that they can't even locate the pitch at all. And so it's just walks. Yeah, I don't
know. Could be. But yeah, so eventually the game, you know, Brewster gives up. He's living on the edge for 3 innings. And then the 3 spot hitter, Dixon, crushes a grand slam. It's 4-1. Jerry Orbach comes out to take him out, which that seems like a weird time to take him out of the game. I know. Right?
Like also, you know, for what? Like, for what purpose? What does it matter? There's nothing. Nothing's happening in this game.
Yeah. Well, he left him in to give up 8 runs against, you know, Durham or whatever, right? Like, why are you going to take him out of 4?
Sorry, this 3-inning exhibition game against the Yankees is too important, kid. I need to take you out that you pay, by the way, which you paid millions of dollars for yourself. Right. Got to take you out for some reason.
Yep. So he gets taken out. He goes into the locker room. The executor who's rooting for him through all this, who shouldn't be, but, you know, whatever, it is the case, is like, hey, by the way, you might win the election. And just so you know, that $60,000 a year mayoral salary would count as an asset. So Brewster goes back out onto the field and withdraws from the race. Says, I thought it was a good idea to do none of the above, but I don't want to be mayor. Don't vote for me. I'm withdrawing. And then they cut away to, so this is the last day. This is day number 30, and we cut away to. I also like this scene. The world's saddest party. Brewster's down to $38,000. And so he's like, I could spend that in my sleep. He throws a big party, and like the brass band is playing like the We Like Being Alive song, right? Like, I mean, it's really well done, like how miserable it went. And all the extras when they're dancing on screen, like, are sulking. Like, it's, I loved this party.
But the problem is Richard Pryor is just not a good actor. Like, he's just not. I'm sorry. He was a funny guy for sure. Yeah. Not an actor. It's terrible. It's not funny. Sorry.
Maybe not in this sequence, but I mean, look, like, he's done a lot of good movies, right?
Was
like,
he good in him? Now I have to go back. He was so bad in this that he's out of his mind on drugs. That's part of it. So maybe if he did any of the movies not on drugs and someone directed him and actually cared about the movie, maybe. Okay, sure.
And Gene Wilder did 200 movies together. So, you know.
I do love me some Gene Wilder, but that doesn't make him a good actor. Whatever.
Anyway, so then it's the next day. It's day number 30. We wake up, you know, Brewster's hungover. He's dead broke. He's got a check out of the hotel. He's back in the clothes that he was wearing when he checked in 30 days ago. He gets to see the room that he wants to die in, right? This is the decorator subplot, right? He goes and stands.
You know what? That room was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Is that, was it supposed to be though? Like, not because it's the 80s. I'm trying to do the upside down world. Like, does that mean, I think it's cool, but then back then it would have read as like, well, this is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. You know, I don't know.
No, I think it's supposed to be.
It looked really good, actually. Yeah, it was good. Wouldn't mind that for a room.
Yeah.
And then she's like, well, pack it up now. Yeah. Since this is a hotel, so it's not, right. We shouldn't have done any of this, of course.
And she does. And this is, I mean, she like after he looks at it, she's excited, and then she snaps her fingers to have the workers. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then you know, Brewster's got to wander through the city to get to the law firm offices because for theatrical reasons he's got to check in at midnight. Right. That's, you know, of course. So he's slowly walking through the city, and then they cut over to more.
Which is weird because the original meeting wasn't at midnight.
Yeah, no, that's right. But what? You know.
So you have 30 days. We'll for no reason put in some overtime to meet with you.
Yeah, throw in a couple of hours just to
whatever.
Whatever. So he's walking through, and we get KXP, all exposition news all the time. I mean, the anchor, Chuck Fleming, Action News, is probably like fourth build in this movie. Like, he's a major character because of all the exposition.
Yeah.
So it turns out more bad law. It turns out that none of the above has won the election, and so as a result, both the mayoral candidates announced that they're not going to run again. And the city
I think
is
they say
have,
like by law, you none of the previous candidates can run again. Is what I'm pretty sure what they say.
And none of that's true.
Yeah.
like if a bunch of people, because what he says is, you know, write
in.
If you
don't get a plurality, then they run off, right? Or something.
Yeah, well, you would just, like, one person would by definition have a plurality. So you would just throw out all the none
of
the
above. No one gets a majority is what I meant to say. Depends on the.
Yeah. If you have, if all you would have is you would just, like, invalidate all the votes for not a person.
Yeah.
So the person with the most votes of those remaining would be mayor. But whatever, it's supposed to be like he did a good thing and caused change in the world. I will tell you, fun trivia fact, there is a because I've watched this on public TV, like in college, and there is a version, there's a public edit of the movie, you know, that cuts out the profanity and that sort of thing that for public broadcast that cuts out this scene, right? So you never, like, find out who wins the election.
Really?
It's just like, yeah, well, no one cares about that shit.
Yeah. Well, you can cut any of the scenes. It doesn't.
No, yeah, this is that was very important.
Terrible movie.
So now we're back at the firm. One more thing I really like about this. Like, there is, and this is the whole unwinding of the plot. They say, oh, he's got 2 minutes until midnight, right? He gets intercepted by the lawyer guy who's sneakily withheld a deposit, hands him $20,000 and is like, congratulations, you're not broke after all. You got $20,000. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to invalidate the whole thing. And Brewster is just so sick and burned out that he goes up and he's like, all right, fine. I lost.
He could just be like, okay, well, thank you for finding this. I'm going to pay you $20,000 for your services.
Though. Yeah, right. There's a million ways out of it,
sense.
Except the way that he gets out of it, which we'll get to in a second. But so he goes up and the executor's like, Mr. Brewster, you still have 2 full minutes. And what I love about this is it actually is 2 minutes now to the end of the movie, right? Like all of the whispering and this and that is it takes place in real time. So he's like, yeah, no, fuck it. I'm not going to go try and spend $20,000 in 2 minutes, even though it'd be preposterously easy to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go sign away. And they bring him out the quick claim form, which, by the way, real thing. And I like that the lawyer's like, use my pen, which I laughed anyway. Like, it was like, yes, sign this right away. And then we cut over to the office and we see lawyer guy, Cox is his name. And he's watching and is like, you know, tenting his fingers together because in 2 minutes he's about to be a full partner in the evil, crimey scheme. And then the accountant comes by and is like, why are you here? And he tells her the plot of the movie, which he's able to summarize in like 35 seconds, right? Like he summarizes. And she's
nothing
like,
happens in this movie.
Because nothing happens. And she's like, okay, you cheated. And so she runs in, there's 10 seconds left. And she's like, he cheated. They put him up to it. And Richard Pryor's like, what? They cheated. He's like, I'm going to need a lawyer. I'll hire you. I'll give you the retainer of $20,000 and you can be my lawyer. And she says, I'm just a paralegal. I don't even have a law degree. And he's like, well, with $20,000, you could get a law degree. And then she gives him a receipt. So and then the executor says, okay, well, you've spent all the money, so I hereby say the inheritance is yours. And by the way, like, then that is like roll credits, right? Like, there is no denouement. There's a dumb like 8 seconds, but like, there's no denouement. There's no, like, you know, nope. It's just like, all right, see, he won. That's it.
Yeah. The nothing that the fuck you did to earn the woman who you shouldn't be interested in, who isn't interested in you. Yeah. It's so.
Yep.
Whatever.
But a couple things on the law. Number one, a retainer is 100% an asset.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So all of a sudden the rules don't matter. Am I the only one who gives a shit about the rules?
The executor says he's going to order an investigation into the conduct, which that's not a thing that executors of wills can do.
Yeah, you wouldn't think.
And I guess the last note I have is that the music that plays over here is a song called "Got to You in the Nick of Time," which
on the nose, I guess. Yeah.
A little on the nose, and was written by Huey Lewis and performed by Patti LaBelle. So there you go.
Well, if there's one thing I do like about 80s movies, it's Huey Lewis blasting. Like, was it Back to the Future? Isn't
yeah.
That? Yeah,
Back to the Future good. Is all like Huey that. Lewis all the time. Yeah.
What a terrible movie. Jeez. Really bad.
Oh,
even
God.
Even the Rotten Tomatoes backs me up on this one. 36%. That's about 34% high.
Wow, that's low. That's pretty
it's
bad.
A bad movie, Andrew. I'm sorry. I hate to break it to you. It's okay. Really bad.
Right.
I think if we counted it, what, 4 or 5 jokes in the hour and a half or hour and 40 minutes?
Yeah. So no, if I told you... If I told you that of the 7 or 8 baseball players, right, 3 or 4 on the Bulls, 3 or 4 on the Yankees, if I told you one of them had actually played in the major leagues.
Oh, you could have told me that the whole Yankees starred in this movie. I wouldn't have known.
So, but here's the thing. Of those, right, a couple, so of 7, 2 are just actors, 4 are minor league players, mostly who washed out at the low levels. But one is an ex-major leaguer who actually was a league leader, right, in one category in 1978 and hit 27 home runs. Who would you think of all the players would be the...
Interesting. Well, yeah. They... Like, which in this movie, what did they do, you mean? Like, which player?
Yeah, which player?
Well,
which player would they...
there is some dialogue with John Candy where he's like, I can't believe you didn't make the All-Star game that one, or that year. So you'd think that guy. But ignoring that, I would actually guess the guy from the beginning who, like, doesn't hit the home run, hits the foul home runs. Like, that guy looked like a professional athlete. So I don't know.
Yeah, he is also just an actor. That's Rudy from the beginning. Okay. Just an actor. There is a brief moment where when Brewster is giving the pep talk in the locker room, he says, Johnson, you can hit the hell out of the ball. You got as good an arm as anyone I've ever seen. But if you don't show it today, no one will ever know.
Right.
And you see him make this great diving stop at third base, right? That's you see that in the game. That's Johnson. Johnson was played by Gary Alexander. It was 32 at the time, despite being 26 in the movie, who, like I said, hit 27 home runs and also led the league in strikeouts in 1978 with 166 batting strikeouts. A little bit of misdirection there on being a league leader, but he does have black ink. He was a real major
166 strikeouts would only take an AJ Pollock another couple games of the playoffs.
Couple of weeks. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So there we go. That is your
baseball
law.
Movie.
Baseball law.
Baseball law.
Yeah. Brewster's Millions. Baseball, the 80s.
I wish I could
millions.
See the 1906 lost version of it. I bet it would be funnier than this. There'd be as many funny lines considering it's a silent movie. It'd be, I guess it's funny placards or something
could,
or whatever.
We could watch that and then watch Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House after that. So. That is a real movie that is the inspiration. Have you seen the Money Pit that Tom Hanks?
Oh, I have. Yeah, actually, I have.
So
seen that.
That's another one of these movies from the 80s that was based off of a like vaudeville thing.
I bet.
Yeah. Mr. Blandings builds his dream house. So there you go.
Hmm. Well, there you have it, folks. All you clamoring for Brewster's Millions. Andrew made it happen.
I made it happen.
Thanks for listening, patrons. Thanks so much for supporting the show. And I hope you enjoyed that. And I can't wait for the next one, which will hopefully not be a shitty 80s movie. It'll be a shitty current TV show.
Yeah, all right. We will. I'm committed to. We'll do this shitty new TV show next.
Yes, it's gonna be so bad. I can't wait.
All right, I can't wait either. All right, we'll thanks, see Thomas. You folks, then. All right, bye.